And I believe that diet is the single greatest lever that we can use to affect health or illness in our bodies, in the bodies of our families, our kids, our brothers, our sisters, our parents, everyone on the earth. Life is good. Check out this review on bone marrow and liver from Heart and Soil Supplements. Prior to starting the bone marrow and liver, I was eating the conventional Western diet. I'm overweight with high blood pressure and acid reflux. When I started the bone marrow and liver, I also started nose-to-tail eating. It was July of 2022 when I started it and included a couple of servings of fruit with each meal. I started with 3 capsules of the organs, walking at least 2 miles every morning, completing CrossFit workouts a few days a week. As of today, December 2nd, I am down 30 pounds and off all prescription medications. Blood pressure is now better than recommended ranges. Fasting glucose is consistently below 90. Looking forward to getting my fasting insulin checked. Prior to starting, it was a little over 8. I have so much energy throughout the day. The changes are amazing, and getting the organs in the bone marrow and liver supplement has made these nutrients in my diet so much easier. Thank you, Heart and Soil. I love this review, guys. You can find bone marrow and liver and all of our supplements at heartandsoil.co. We make grass-fed, grass-finished, freeze-dried organs in a glass bottle, the finest on the planet, sourced exclusively from New Zealand. And getting organs in your life is critical. If you can't get them fresh, check us out, heartandsoil.co. When this podcast comes out, Heart and Soil is doing the Animal Base 30, so join us for that at animalbase30.com. On this week's episode of the podcast, I wanted to start the year off high level. What is an animal-based diet? How do you do this? What is animal-based diet 101? In this podcast, I'm going to walk you through this step by step. I'm going to give you 4 steps for things to remove from your diet and 4 steps for things to add to your diet to really make your diet an animal-based diet, which I believe is the optimal starting point for humans. If you've listened to my podcast before, a lot of the concepts in this one are going to be familiar, but I always try to put in new pieces of information. In this one specifically, I talk about high fructose corn syrup, differences in sugars, and artificial sweeteners, something I haven't talked about on the podcast in the past, but some new data that I came across is very compelling. So I think you guys will enjoy this one. Hope your year is starting off well. Here's to an amazing, healthy, and fruitful and vital year. This podcast is free, and I want to give a shout out to my sponsors who help make it possible. I want to start with my friend Monsol's company called sacredhunting.com. You can get $250 off your hunting trip with Monsol with the code Paul at sacredhunting.com. Monsol's great. I went on a hunt with him this past year in 2022, and he will teach you the basics of how to track, stalk, kill, and field dress wild game animals. And what's cool about Monsol's stuff is sacred hunting adds ritual and Native American components that make this a rite of passage. The people that go on these hunts are not just your average hunters. They're people who are looking for this rite of passage, who respect the land, who respect the animals, and who respect ways of eating that nourish themselves and their communities. So it's a really cool experience. Not to say that the average hunter is anything less than awesome. It's just, this is a unique experience for many of the people that go on these hunts. This past year, we went out to West Texas and I shot a black buck antelope with a rifle. Previously, I've been on hunts with Monsol once before where I shot a deer with a bow. Both were experiences that I will never forget. They were great. Again, Fundamental Health listeners will save $250 off their trip by mentioning my name, Paul's name, Paul. 2 dates are specifically set up for interested people from this podcast, March 16th to 19th, 2023. And April 13th to 16th, 2023. There are only 5 spots on each hunt. So visit sacredhunting.com/Paul. Fill out the 2-minute application, set up an exploratory call. That's sacredhunting.com/Paul. You guys also know that I really like red light and light therapy in general. One of the reasons I live in Costa Rica is because I get lots of ultraviolet light. And I really appreciate having the access to red light here as well, in the evenings especially. So as you start the new year, think about where you're getting your nutrients from with your food, but also where you're getting your light nutrients from. This is a non-negotiable for me. I've been using Juve for years. It's easy, it's relaxing, and it makes a big difference. There's so much research on red light now. It's actually pretty incredible how much has been done here. So you've heard me talk about Juve before. J-O-O-V-V, 2 O's, 2 V's. I use my device daily to support healthy cellular function, which is the foundation of our health. Usually I use it at night before I go to sleep, and it really helps me turn off and kind of in a calming way before I get there. There are tons of clinically proven benefits: reduced pain, inflammation, enhanced sleep, etc., better muscle recovery, skin improvements. I've probably seen all of these with my use of this. Their devices are really high quality. They were the originators in this device in making it portable and available to people's homes. So they've been doing it for a while. Health doesn't have to be complicated. Making it simple with Juve is what it's all about. So go check out the Juves, Juovvs, their red light therapies today. And while you're there, Juve is offering all my listeners an exclusive discount on their first order. Go to Juve, Juovv.com/Paul, and apply my code, which is Paul, to your qualifying order. Juovv.com/Paul. Pick up a Juve today. Some exclusions may apply. Last but not least, this podcast is sponsored by Let's Get Checked. You can find them at trylgc.com/Paul Saladino. That's a long one. It's Paul Saladino. It's not just Paul. And you will get 25% off your labs when you do that. So what is Let's Get Checked? It is a platform to order your own labs and get them tested in your home. Super convenient. And the question that most of us men should be asking ourselves these days are we the same men that our fathers were from a testosterone perspective? There's a real decline in testosterone over the last 30 years. And most of us, I fear that we look at ourselves, we'll say, oh, my dad's testosterone was probably higher than mine when he was my age. All sorts of effects of low testosterone: low sex drive, erectile dysfunction, mood disorders, impaired sleep, impaired recovery. But Let's Get Checked helps you get your testosterone and male hormones checked, which is a critical first step toward improving this. I did a podcast last year about how to help fix your testosterone, but you have to know what your testosterone is doing. So the way it works is you go online, you order your test, they send it to you in discreet packaging. You collect your blood at home yourself. It's super easy and painless, saves you time and energy going to a doctor's office. You don't have to deal with a doctor ordering the blood work. You can just order it yourself. And you get the results in 2 to 5 days. They're reviewed by a clinician. A member of the Let's Get Checked nursing team may call you to review your results. Let's Get Checked labs are CLIA approved, CAP accredited at the highest level of accreditation. And so if you want to do this, I recommend getting your hormones checked, guys. Among with other things, they do CRP, they do lipids, they do CBC, they do all kinds of things. Try LGC, trylgc.com/Paul Saladino, and get 25% off your test using the code Paul Saladino. It's a long code, but you guys know it. All right, guys, on to the podcast. Welcome to 2023, my friends. At the beginning of the year, I always like to start out high level with the podcast. So in this podcast, I want to take you through my conceptualization of what an animal-based diet is, why I think this is an optimal starting point for the human diet, and I'm going to differentiate that from the optimal diet for humans in a moment. And I'm going to take you through 4 steps of removal and 4 steps of adding foods to get to an animal-based diet. So I want to make this easy for you all. Even if you're familiar with an animal-based diet or are eating animal-based or like that in your diet, there will be many nuggets of new information and interesting nuances of various aspects of an animal-based diet in this podcast. So I hope it will still be valuable for those who are doing an animal-based diet and quite familiar with this way of eating. But like I said, at the beginning of the year, I want to start out high level and just talk about animal-based diet 101, why I think this is a good diet for humans and how to do it. And I will remind you guys of this throughout the podcast, but Heart and Soil and I are doing a free animal-based challenge. You can sign up at animalbased30.com. It's called Animal-Based 30 in the month of January. So it's going on now. If you're interested in eating this way and you're using this podcast as a starting point, the Animal-Based 30 will be very helpful for you as well. So check that out, animalbased30.com. There are tons of resources there. So the beginning of this exploration into human diet is personal, professional. I'm a doctor, and I believe that diet is the single greatest lever that we can use to affect health or illness in our bodies, in the bodies of our families, our kids, our brothers, our sisters, our parents, everyone on the earth. A very, very small percentage, less than 1%, probably less than 0.1% of the illness that we observe within Western medicine is related to immutable, that is, unchangeable genetic defects, quote unquote. These are genetic, quote, mutations that are unfixable. The majority of what we see, 99.5, 99.7, perhaps even 99.9% of what we see in Western medicine, is chronic illness that I think is ameliorated, improved, sometimes completely reversed with dietary changes. So why within Western medicine is the majority of what we learn pharmaceuticals, which don't address the root cause, and we really are never challenged as physicians in medical school and residency, or healthcare practitioners, nurse practitioners, PAs, even nurses, to think about the root cause of illness? If so much of what we treat as doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs is malleable with diet, at least half of what we learn in medical school should be about nutrients and dietary strategies and the literature regarding various diets and the literature suggesting mechanisms and having debates about seed oils, pro and con, and having debates about artificial sweeteners. This is what should be happening in medical school. Sadly, none of that happens, which is why I do what I do and why many others who are also doing great work do what they do, because we're trying to educate. So I no longer see patients. I do educational stuff because I've realized that I can affect more lives positively in this way. And this is what I feel called to. This is what I enjoy the most. I found medical school residency, even my time as a physician assistant before I went to medical school at the University of Arizona, all very constraining and very frustrating because the medical system is not always set up to allow physicians to make these interventions. Yes, there are some great physicians out there who are seeing patients in clinical practice, but that's hard to scale. And so podcasts, free information, Instagram, YouTube, et cetera, I think this is how a lot of people are really, really changing their health for the better. So the overarching question, which has always been interesting for me, is how do we create health in humans with diet? What are we doing now that is harming us? What are we doing too little of that could be increased, that could help us? What are we doing too much of that's harming us, et cetera? And is there one optimal diet for humans that will allow us all to thrive? It will probably come as no surprise to you. Perhaps you will be surprised to hear me say this, that I believe there's no one optimal diet for humans. But I do believe there's an optimal diet starting point for humans based on my research, writing a book, writing a cookbook, working with clients, my own personal experience, visiting hunter-gatherers in Africa, looking at anthropology. I think there's an optimal starting point for humans, which is to say that if you are suffering, if you have autoimmune disease, eczema, psoriasis, type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel conditions. I think a lot of people have autoimmune diseases, don't even know they have them. If you have psychiatric disease, depression, anxiety, bipolar, psychotic disorders, these are also autoimmune and neuroinflammatory, in my opinion. Cardiovascular disease has an immune component and I think could be considered autoimmune. But if you have any of these chronic diseases, obesity, diabetes, thinking about how to optimize your diet and align your diet with your body, I think is the most important thing you can do for your future health. And that will change the quality of your life radically and allow you to do what you want to do in your life. So I can't think of too many things that are more important than focusing on that. So then the question is, if you have those things, this is what I believe and I will recommend to you. I want you to take this with a grain of salt, to think about it, to question what I'm saying, not to accept what I'm saying as dogma, but to make your own decisions. And hopefully this information helps you move to that position. But I think this is an optimal starting point in my belief. This is where I think a lot of humans, the majority of humans, could start their diets and see massive improvements and then tweak things along the way, which I'll talk about throughout this podcast. Before I even get into what I believe is an optimal diet for humans or an optimal starting point for humans, let's accept some conditions for this exploration. I am looking at all of this through a lens of trying to find a diet for humans that has the most nutrients, the most bioavailability of those nutrients, meaning if the nutrients, the vitamins, the minerals, the cofactors, the peptides are present in food, that we can absorb them, right? So not just the most absolute amount of nutrients, the most bioavailable amount of nutrients, that adds a whole nother layer. I'm looking for a diet that has the least amount of toxins. And by toxins, I mean things like heavy metals, perfluoroalkylated substances, also known as PFAs, BPA, BPS, xenoestrogens, microplastics, but also plant defense chemicals, which I would see as toxic for many individuals. The degree of that toxicity will vary from person to person. Mileage may vary, But I do believe that many plant chemicals are harmful for us, and a lot of people do better when they eliminate these. So that's the framework that I'm using to think about diet. What has the most nutrients? What aligns best with our human metabolism as well? What allows our mitochondria to function well in the best way possible based on history and evolution and anthropology and biochemistry and medicine? And what has the least amount of toxins, toxins that can harm us, toxins that can inhibit the absorption of nutrients? That's the framework. That's the question I'm trying to answer, because that's how I would define broadly what an optimal diet, dietary starting point for humans would be. And from the outset, I will say that my bias is that our history tells us a lot of these answers. I don't believe we are smart enough to design Soylent Green, which for those of you who aren't familiar is a, I think, historical literature reference that has actually been made into a real drink, just a liquid drink that has everything humans need and you can just drink it and it's super easy, never have to think about food. I don't think most of us would want that type of experience with food. Some of us might for convenience, but I don't think that exists, because I think that there are even nutrients, vitamins, minerals, cofactors that we're not aware of in the foods that we eat. And by mimicking what humans have done for hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens or millions of years as pre-Homo sapien hominids, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, I think that we fill in a lot of that nutritional dark matter. Just like within your gut and my gut, 60%+ of the microbes, viruses, fungi are uncharacterized. We don't even know what they are. I think a lot of nutrition, hopefully not 60%, but the number could be that high, is nutrients and cofactors and interplay that we're not even aware of. So reductionism within nutrition, I think, is quite dangerous, and we see it repeatedly fail. That's something that I will say is a theme throughout my experience. If we become too reductionist and we try and tweak too hard with tons of vitamins or synthetic substances, the human body doesn't tend to react well to that, because we're missing levels of complexity that we can't even appreciate as humans that are found in whole foods. So I'm going to think about this from a whole foods perspective. And as I said, I'm going to break this down in the easiest way with four removal steps. I want to make a step-by-step guide here of how to make your diet the optimal starting point for humans. So four removal steps and then four addition steps. And I think if you get through those 8 steps, which can be done four removal steps first, and then the four addition steps where you can do them in parallel, add something, take something out, add something, take something out. But I wanted to make it step by step so that you guys can understand what I think the most important steps are. The whole podcast is framed from the perspective of an animal-based diet, something that I believe is the optimal starting point for humans. And I'll tell you what that is, and then I will reverse engineer it in some ways and talk about the steps that I've used to get to that point in the podcast. So an animal-based diet is organs and meat, the most nutrient-rich foods for humans that I've ever seen, prized by hunter-gatherers throughout our evolution, clearly prized today. Organs and meat for protein and nutrients and some animal fats. Dairy, preferably raw dairy, as an animal food that is nutritious for humans and a source of calcium and other unique nutrients. Eggs, animal foods. So the animal foods are there. And then a carbohydrate source for humans from fruit and honey, which I believe to be the least toxic sources of carbohydrates. So an animal-based diet is, succinctly put, organs, meat, fruit, honey, raw dairy. It's kind of just a term that I've coined. Again, I want you to question these things and think for yourself and not just accept this as canon. But that's what I mean when I say an animal-based diet. And like I said, I think that if you look at the literature and you look for the most nutrient-rich foods with the most bioavailable nutrients and the least amount of toxins, both human-created toxins, heavy metals, perfluoroalkylated substances, microplastics, and toxins that occur in foods, plant defense chemicals, things like oxalates or phytic acid or other plant defense chemicals, lectins that can harm us like gluten or other lectins, you end up with something akin to an animal-based diet. I'll talk a little about proportions and macros in this podcast as well to help you guys break it down and really come to a concrete understanding of how you might construct a diet for yourself that looks like this. So with that said, let's talk about the first four removal steps. I think that with human psychology, it may be a mistake to do this. People want to know what they can add rather than what to remove. But I think that the removal steps are critically important to this process. And I think that if you did nothing else but remove these things from your diet, these four steps that I'm about to give you, I think your diet would improve and you would feel better. You don't even have to add anything. I think that if you just cut these foods out, you will become healthier. Obviously, the optimal condition for this pursuit of the optimal human diet, the optimal condition for this adventure that you're going to go on, maybe your family will go on, is to both add things and take things away. So add the good things, take the negative things away. First step, step one, in terms of the four removal steps. If you do nothing else, I believe that removing seed oils, surprise, surprise, not to anyone that's listened to my stuff, removing seed oils will improve your health. That simple step. Now, to be fair, seed oils are found in a lot of foods, and removing seed oils will mean that a lot of processed foods that you may have enjoyed previously will not be on the menu. But again, removing seed oils, doing that one thing, I believe will result in massive improvements in your health. Seed oils are things like corn, canola, sunflower, safflower, soybean, grapeseed. Anything that comes from a seed is a seed oil. Even palm oil is a seed oil in many ways because it's also refined, bleached, and deodorized. I've done multiple podcasts on the dangers of seed oils. I don't really want to get into the weeds of why seed oils are harmful too much in this podcast, other than to say that they are high in a polyunsaturated omega-6 fatty acid called linoleic acid, which appears to have problems at many levels for humans. Problems in terms of satiety by activating cannabinoid receptors in the human body, making us hungry. Problems at the level of the brain, problems at the level of our cell membranes, problems at the level of mitochondria by populating a component of the mitochondrial membrane known as cardiolipin. Problems at the level of the mitochondria by activating cannabinoid receptors and causing some degree of mitochondrial dysfunction. So in my diet, I have purposely constructed it to minimize linoleic acid. And that means that I also do not consume animal foods that are particularly high in linoleic acid. I'll get to that in a little bit. And I do not consume oils like avocado or olive, which are not technically seed oils, but they do have more linoleic acid than the animal fats that I prefer. So animal fats, tallow, butter, ghee, these kind of things, 2 to 3% linoleic acid. Chickens raised in the wild, 4 to 5% linoleic acid in their fat. Pigs raised in the wild, 4 to 5% linoleic acid in their fat. Seed oils start around 20 to 25% for canola, going up to 65% for things like sunflower or grapeseed. And below seed oils are things like avocado and olive, which can have anywhere from 8 to 25% linoleic acid. So I don't see a reason, if I have animal fat available, to use plant fats that have more linoleic acid in them. I'm not putting dressings on my salad. I don't think that's a good thing to do. I don't cook in oil. And as I've talked about in Instagram on Reels, if I do cook in oil, I'm cooking in tallow, butter, or ghee, low linoleic acid oils that are much more stable. I would never cook in olive oil or avocado because they have much more linoleic acid, 2, 3, 4, 5x, than animal fats. And that is going to oxidize. It's very fragile when you heat it. We know that. One of the worst places you'll find seed oils is French fries or French fries, which we know have large amounts of a linoleic acid breakdown product called HNE, more specifically 4-HNE. No surprise, potatoes fried in seed oils are some of the least satiating foods, the most hunger-reducing foods on the planet. Potatoes by themselves, actually pretty satiating. Potatoes fried in seed oils, which are going to have HNE, big, big problem. So removing seed oils from your diet is number one. Do nothing else. Take nothing else from this podcast and your health will improve. And I'll just add the personal note that it has been very hard to help my family with this. So I have empathy for many of you who are looking in your pantries and going, at least half of my pantry has seed oils. Go slow, but do it. Get it out of your life. Use other oils and don't eat the foods that have seed oils. Number two, remove high fructose corn syrup from your diet. This one may be more familiar to most of you, but there's some nuance here that's important to point out. High fructose corn syrup is different than sucrose. It's a completely different product made from a corn syrup that appears to be more fattening, more weight gain inducing in animal models and probably in humans, but certainly in animal models, even relative to sucrose. I'm not a huge fan of table sugar. I don't know why you would eat table sugar when there are better ways to get carbohydrates in a simple form that's going to be easily digestible, like fruit, good freshly squeezed or made fruit juice, and honey or maple syrup. But at a biochemical level, pure sucrose, which is a disaccharide of glucose and fructose, is different than high fructose corn syrup. Now, in terms of the fructose concentrations, fructose in sucrose would be 50-50 with glucose. In high fructose corn syrup, it's perhaps a little higher, 55-45 fructose to glucose. But that 5% of fructose is probably not the real issue here. It appears to be cornstarch, hidden starches, or hidden sources of calories in the high fructose corn syrup that make it particularly fattening, quote unquote, particularly weight gain inducing. So we've been told for many generations that sucrose, quote unquote, sugar is bad for us. And I think that the more accurate thing I would say is high fructose corn syrup is bad for you and is really bad for you. So don't give your kids high fructose corn syrup. I actually wouldn't have a problem recommending honey maple syrup or fruit juice even to my niece and nephew. And I've had those conversations with my sister. And in my own life and the clients that I've worked with, fruit, honey, maple syrup, fruit juice even do not raise hemoglobin A1C significantly. They do not raise fasting glucose. They do not raise fasting insulin. They don't make you more insulin resistant. I've spoken about that at length in the past. So number two, remove high fructose corn syrup. I'm going to do a whole podcast on different types of sugars and artificial sweeteners probably next week. So stay tuned for that. But I did want to share this article. If you're watching on YouTube, high fructose corn syrup prompts considerably more weight gain, researchers find. This is March 22 from Princeton University. I'm looking at a Science Daily report, so it's kind of high level. The summary is researchers demonstrate that all sweeteners are not equal when it comes to weight gain. Rats with access to high fructose corn syrup gain significantly more weight than those with access to table sugar, even when their overall caloric intake was the same. That pretty much says it all. And as I said, I would say that, and this will trigger some keto advocates, that sucrose may not be harmful for humans. At least the literature begins to ask us to make that question in our lives. But why would you do that? I don't eat sucrose or table sugar in my life. I don't see a point to that. If you look at my previous podcast from last year in 2022 with Chronometer, you'll see that maple syrup has manganese and coconut water has magnesium and honey has nitric oxide precursors. And we know that maple syrup has other nutrients and minerals. We also know that molasses or other less processed forms of sugar have nutrients and minerals. So I would rather get manganese and magnesium and other micronutrients in the foods that I'm eating than eat pure sugar for my calories. But it begs an interesting question regarding the biochemistry of all of this. And high fructose corn syrup looks to be particularly bad for a variety of reasons. You can refer to the Georgi Dinkov podcast from the end of 22 if you have questions about that more, and look for next week's podcast where I'll go into that in much more detail. So that is number two. We have remove seed oils, remove high fructose corn syrup. Right now, you've probably eliminated 80% of the processed food in your cabinets. So we're on a good track. We know that processed food is very harmful for humans. Number three, this one may surprise you guys. So this is important not to ignore or miss. Remove artificial sweeteners. There's been a lot of back and forth in the nutrition sphere about artificial sweeteners. Yes, they don't have calories, but there's some very interesting research both on the way that artificial sweeteners, things like stevia, sucralose, which is Splenda, aspartame, can interrupt quorum sensing, which is communication between the microbes in your gut. And even more compelling to me is the research from Dana Small at Yale University. Hopefully I'll get her on the podcast soon. But I'm going to show an article from her group from 2020. And what happened in this article was that Splenda was added to a drink with dextrose. So sucralose, a non-caloric sweetener, was added to a drink with dextrose, which is an oligosaccharide of glucose, so pure glucose. So there's no fructose in this drink. And what you have then when humans consume this drink, you have a mismatch between presented nutrients and sweetness. And what happened in both adult humans and especially in adolescent humans was that when carbohydrates were presented with artificial sweeteners, specifically sucralose in this case, people became insulin resistant really fast. There were metabolic derangements. I've never heard anyone talk about this in the health space. And hat tip to my friend Andrew Huberman, who turned me on to this research, but Andrew hasn't spoken about it yet on his podcast. I'm sure he will. But so many of the advocates for artificial sweeteners, I've never heard them address this. I don't think they're aware of this. Now, to be complete in my recount of this study's findings, and I'll show you the reference in a moment if you're watching on YouTube, when pure sucralose was given in a drink, there was no negative effect. But how often do humans only drink something with sucralose or only eat something with sucralose that has no other carbohydrates naturally occurring? Or how often do we eat something with sucralose or drink something with sucralose with other foods? So there is a possibility you would not escape the way that sucralose and other artificial sweeteners will affect the communication between your gut microbes. But there's a possibility that you could have a Diet Coke in the middle of the day with nothing else, no calories, no carbohydrates, and that may not be as harmful to your metabolism as drinking a Diet Coke with a, I don't know, whatever you want to eat, a piece of toast, a piece of fruit, a hamburger, anything with carbohydrates in it with that sucralose-containing beverage or food is going to mess up your body's connections between sweetness and presented calories, and that leads to insulin resistance in humans. It also does it in animal studies, but this is in humans, guys. So the other thing to note is that there are over 3,000 foods, probably close to 4,000 foods at this point, that have sucralose in them and added calories in the form of sugar. Why would they do that? Well, sucralose is sweet. So sucralose is also cheaper than sugar. So manufacturers can make something sweeter and say that it has less sugar and they can cut costs, but you're absolutely messing up the metabolism. I'm thinking about a lot of drinks. I believe Logan Paul's drink Prime has an artificial sweetener and sugar in it. And a lot of these drinks are doing this now, saying they have less sugar, but they're giving you sugar, they're giving you carbohydrates, and they're giving you an artificial sweetener. That is very bad. And in fact, I think they would be better off from a metabolic perspective, either doing pure sucralose, which I don't think is the right option, or pure sugar, not high fructose corn syrup. From a metabolic perspective, pure sugar in those drinks would be better than sucralose plus sugar. So these drinks are a metabolic nightmare for humans, and yet we've just begun to understand this in the research, and no one is being held accountable for this, and they're being marketed as lower sugar. This is actually a really, really important finding, something that you should not ignore. So let me show you this article. Title of the paper is "Short-Term Consumption of Sucralose with, but Not Without, Carbohydrate Impairs Neural and Metabolic Sensitivity to Sugar in Humans." It's from Cell Metabolism 2020. Again, the final author is Dana Small. You can find her YouTube presentation at the Neuron Conference, which talks about this at around minute 36. So I gave you guys a summary of what happened in this. If you really want to go read the paper, you can see it. But this is a metabolic nightmare for humans, and no one should ignore this. And no one who is saying that artificial sweeteners are benign should be allowed to say that without explaining this finding and explaining how this is somehow benign for humans. I think this is horrible for humans. So step three, remove artificial sweeteners. Do not mess with this stuff, guys. And yes, this means stevia. And yes, this means monk fruit. Until we have data to show those are any different, you are mismatching a sweet taste with a caloric presentation. And I believe that is going to cause metabolic derangement in humans. So I've always been suspicious of monk fruit and stevia for a variety of reasons, but I don't think monk fruit is good for humans. And I think that this could be causing a divergence and a derangement in insulin sensitivity if you are eating those foods with presented other carbohydrates. And there's good data to suggest this, at least with sucralose. We need to do these studies with stevia, aspartame, and monk fruit as well to prove that those are not doing the same thing. We definitely know this with Splenda, which is sucralose. Again, 3,000 foods out there have sucralose and presented calories, like all these drinks and things like this, which are totally messing up our metabolism as humans. Step number four, remove vegetables. This is obviously the most controversial one, but I think it's important. Now, let me describe what vegetables are. These are the non-fruit parts of plants. This is technical definition. Avocado is a fruit, guys. Avocado is not a vegetable. Squash is a fruit, not a vegetable. Okay, leaves and stems and seeds of plants are vegetables. Roots are technically vegetables as well. Removing leaves and stems and seeds from your diet, I believe, will improve your health, especially seeds. Now, seeds are seeds, nuts, grains, and beans. I'm not going to go into all that in this podcast, but suffice it to say that beans and grains are problematic for humans from a digestive enzyme perspective, containing digestive enzyme inhibitors, containing phytic acid, containing lectins, a la gluten, etc. I don't believe grains are a good thing for humans or are adding anything to your life. I actually don't think nuts are adding anything to your life. You can get all the nutrients in the nuts in much more bioavailable forms in meat, organs, fruit, honey, and raw dairy. Refer to the podcast I did last year on Chronometer, where I show you my diet. There is nothing missing on Chronometer from an animal-based diet in terms of any nutrients, not thiamine, not magnesium, not manganese, whatever people think is missing from this type of diet. I've shown it on Chronometer that it's adequate. So I think nuts and seeds are messing with your digestion. I think grains and beans are definitely messing with your digestion. I think that leaves are highly defended and have problematic compounds in them that are not good for you. I did a short YouTube video, sauna versus broccoli, last year, where I talked about why I don't believe leafy greens or vegetables have any real substantiated hormetic benefits in humans. I think that any benefits of those are outweighed by their negatives, and those hormetic quote unquote benefits of vegetables are redundant when you're doing other things in your life, like, I don't know, walking in the sunlight, doing even moderate amounts of exercise, weightlifting, things like this, sauna, heat, cold. Those are our hormetics, and they activate the same systems, the NRF2 system, to optimize glutathione that vegetables may, but they come without the other harmful, damaging compounds in vegetables. This has probably been the hardest thing to explain to people clearly, which I take responsibility for. I guess I've not done a good job of explaining it, but it seems to be a difficult thing for people to wrap their heads around, so I will keep trying to explain it and think about it in a way that makes more sense or that holds up to continued scrutiny. So four is remove vegetables, that is leaves, stems, and seeds, seeds being seeds, nuts, grains, and beans from your diet. And steps 1, 2, and 3 were remove seed oils, remove high fructose corn syrup, and remove artificial sweeteners. So we've done the 4 removal steps. We can get to the 4 addition steps now. I just wanted to break it down this way. I'm not trying to make this onerous. I'm just wanting to make it very clear for you guys so you can do these things. An animal-based 30 has started at Hardened Soil. We have a whole team there, health success guides. It's a free challenge, animal-based 30, to sign up. If you want to walk through these steps with some people guiding you or be part of a community on Facebook or online that where people are talking about what works and what doesn't. Step number 1 for addition. Add organs to your diet. The Hadza eat the organs first. So many animals that eat other animals eat the organs first. Organs are nutritious in unique ways. Let's just start with liver. 1/2 ounce of liver a day, 3.5 ounces of liver a week is great. Perhaps ideal. You don't need much more than that. 1/2 ounce of liver is the size of like a nickel. I mean, weigh it out. It's not a lot of liver. If you watch me on Instagram at CarnivoreMD2.0, you'll know that my favorite way to eat liver is just to freeze it because then it doesn't spoil. And I cut it up into small pieces and I eat a little nickel-sized piece every day of liver. I'm not eating 1 pound of liver. I'm not eating 3 ounces of liver at every meal. I'm just eating 1/2 ounce of liver every day. And if you look at Chronometer, you'll see adding 1/2 ounce of liver, either fresh or desiccated, like we make it Hardened Soil, will significantly improve the nutrients in your diet. You'll get things like copper, which are hard to get, bioavailable vitamin A, biotin, folate, riboflavin, the list is long. Liver also contains unique peptides, hepcidin, hepatocyte growth factor, things that we're just beginning to understand how beneficial they are for humans. Liver also contains ergothionine, appears to be associated with longevity or decreased cognitive decline with aging, but ergothionine looks beneficial and it's in liver. So liver is a good place to start. I also really like heart. Liver and heart are my 2 favorite organs, and I think they are the place to start. I eat much more heart than I do liver. I've been eating actually more heart recently, 6-7 ounces a day. In fact, one of my meals is exclusively heart now. I'm always experimenting with this. I'll have one meal that's ground beef and one meal that's heart. And I appreciate heart because it's high in taurine, a valuable amino acid that's hard to get otherwise, and serine. Coenzyme Q10 is richest in heart. Heart also contains testosterone, and heart is a good source of riboflavin. I happen to have an MTHFR polymorphism, which means that I need more riboflavin in my diet to keep my homocysteine at a level that I think is ideal. And I think heart is the best source of that. So a little bit of liver, 5-7 ounces of heart a day seems to be ideal for me. Other organs that I will eat, stomach, intestines. These are much harder to eat fresh unless you're used to them. I've eaten brains. I don't get that very often. I'll eat testicles. But this is where I think the desiccated organs, like we make at Hardened Soil, become very valuable. Those other organs certainly have unique value that I've spoken about in the past, whether it's kidney for DAO and histamine intolerance, or thymus for immune support, or gut support through eating stomach and intestines, which probably have unique peptides. We know the stomach contains BPC-157. There are unique compounds in brain, phosphatidylserine, probably unique fatty acids that help people with mood issues that have been shown to improve cognitive decline in the elderly in controlled trials in humans with desiccated cow brain, which is what we have in mood, memory, and brain from Hardened Soil. So I prefer that you get all your organs fresh, but if you can't, there are other options, like I mentioned here. So get organs in your diet is step one. Step two is probably eating more meat, but getting enough high quality meat in your diet is step two. Now, how much meat should you eat? We're getting into the macros now. Macros are protein, carbohydrates, and fat. At carnivoremd.com, there's a free calculator based on your body weight and your activity level to give you a sense of what macros I would recommend. High level, for women, I would say 0.9 grams of protein per day per pound of body weight or goal body weight. For men, it's about 1 gram per pound of body weight. So I'm 165 grams. And interestingly, through intuitive meanderings, I've ended up right around there from protein throughout the day. One adjustment that I've made recently is a little bit less animal muscle meat, a little more of the organs, and more protein from things like raw whole milk and raw cheese. Thinking about a calcium phosphorus balance with the dairy and the meat as well. And you can hear a little bit about that on the podcast with Georgie Dinkov. I'll have to do more in the future. We're probably going to get Georgie back on the podcast. But there are lots of ways to get to that amount of protein for you. Again, I'm 165, which means I'm getting anywhere from 160 to 180 grams of protein per day from a mix of things. I'll have maybe 7 ounces of hard, 8 ounces of grass-fed ground beef, a liter of raw milk, 5, 6, 7 ounces of raw cheese. And then I'm at my protein goals. You can add eggs in there if you want. Eggs are 6 grams of protein per egg. So you can adjust. If you tolerate dairy, having that in there, I think is going to be great. If you don't tolerate dairy, start slow, try it fermented, try yogurts, try kefirs, and or use a lactase pill, the enzyme that degrades lactose. I think raw milk is better for a variety of reasons. I've spoken about the fact that kids in multiple studies who grow up eating raw milk, both on and off farms, have lower rates of asthma, allergies, and eczema. There seems to be something protective about the raw milk. And the subsequent research that I've seen suggests that it has to do with the whey protein rather than specific probiotics in the raw milk. And the whey protein gets denatured when you heat the milk. There's something protective about a whey protein in milk. It's really interesting, I think. I've spoken about that on my social media as well. So get enough protein is step two from a variety of those sources. Again, carnivoremd.com for a clear animal-based calculator, which wraps into or segues into point three, which is get the proper amount of carbohydrates in your diet. I do believe that humans do best when they have carbohydrates in the diet. If you limit your carbohydrates too much, we know that cortisol to cortisone ratio goes up, meaning you get more cortisol, less cortisone, which leads to stress effects, which leads to all sorts of problems in the human body. Having a lot of cortisol is not good. Electrolyte problems, sleep problems, hormone problems. Limiting your carbohydrates, I think, is a problematic thing for humans. Thyroid will decline, causing problems with weight gain and weight loss long-term. And these are difficult to recover from. My personal story is that while a carnivore diet free of all plant matter improved my eczema, it led to massive electrolyte problems, sleep problems, and declining hormones for me, which improved when I added fruit and honey back. So I've done so many episodes now on why fruit and honey are not to be feared. I spoke about it a little earlier in the podcast. This type of sugar in whole foods matrix contains micronutrients that come with it. And there's really no good studies in humans to suggest that they're harmful in any way, shape, or form. But there are some interesting studies in humans to suggest that limiting your carbohydrates too much can be harmful for humans. Recently did a video on YouTube, which was titled "There Are No Hidden Dangers on Fruit and Honey," where I spoke about the fact that Atkins diets, which can be keto, are known to increase methylglyoxal, an advanced glycation end product, on the order of 2.2 times. And then I showed multiple studies showing that methylglyoxal appears to be harmful for humans. So I've never heard anyone in the keto community really talk about why increased methylglyoxal is not a problem, but It certainly wasn't something I was aware of when I was on a ketogenic diet. So I do think step three, get enough carbohydrates in your diet from fruit, from honey, from fruit juice. One of the things I've been really enjoying recently is fresh squeezed orange juice. It's delicious and it's a good source of vitamin C, other micronutrients, and carbohydrates. Again, there's an animal-based calculator. I keep referring to this because I think that knowing what a starting point is for your macros, that is fat, carbohydrates, and protein, will be very helpful for you as you create this diet. There also are health success guides at Heart and Soil, animalbase30.com, to help you with all this along your journey. So for me, I'm 165 pounds and I'm very active, which means that in my mind, I exercise for more than 12 hours a week because I surf for more than 2 hours every single day. So I think a lot of people don't need as many carbohydrates as I do, but I eat a lot per day. I eat 250 to 300 grams of carbohydrates. My fasting insulin remains 3 or lower. My fasting glucose remains around 85, et cetera. I'm very insulin sensitive with this amount of carbohydrates. Carbohydrates don't cause insulin resistance. And in the podcast next week, you'll hear me talk about the fact that if you give honey to a diabetic, giving honey to a diabetic, that's crazy. You can't do that. Their insulin sensitivity improves. Their hemoglobin A1C goes up because the blood sugar is going to go up, but their fasting insulin and fasting glucose go down. I don't think diabetics need to be eating tons of honey, but really the problems with diabetes are related to hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance ultimately. Having really high glucose is not a good thing. We don't want to get into the hugely high glucose ranges, but a little bump in hemoglobin A1C is not the end of the world, guys, especially if you're more insulin sensitive. The confusion here is that often within Western medicine, your A1C goes up, you become less insulin sensitive, your fasting insulin is going to go up as well. But if those are divergent, we have something interesting going on. So if you have diabetes, if you have obesity, I think some moderate amount of carbohydrates may be good for you. In fact, I'll rephrase that. I think carbohydrates will still be good for you based on your activity level. If you're not exercising a ton or you're exercising an hour or half an hour a day, based on your body weight, 100, 120, 130 grams of carbohydrates is probably all you need. And I believe that fruit and honey are the best sources of that. In contradistinction to things like oats or grains or wheat or pasta or rice, I believe those are inferior sources of carbohydrates. I want to be very clear about the distinction. So the fourth thing that I want you to do for an animal-based diet is eat animal fat to get your fats. So number one was eat organs. And then we had protein, carbohydrates, and fat, the three macronutrients for 2, 3, and 4. So what are the sources of fat that I think would be ideal for you? Not avocado, not olive. They're not the end of the world. They're way better than seed oils, but they're not my ideal for reasons I mentioned earlier, linoleic acid, tallow, butter, ghee, and fatty meats. So I'm getting ground beef. It's 80-20. I don't look for the lean ground beef. I want the fatty ground beef. What I have found in my experience is that fat will consistently be my highest macronutrient group. Because fat has 9 calories per gram canonically, there's just no way for me to not have fat be the majority of calories in my diet. This is just where I've ended up, but right now my macros look something like 170 grams of protein per day, around, let's just be generous, 300 grams of carbohydrates, and somewhere around 130 to 140 grams of fat per day. If you do the math on that, that comes out to 3,140 calories. That's probably on the low side for me most days. And if you do the macro breakdown, you find that it's about 40% fat, about 38% carbohydrates, and about 21% protein. So again, as I stated at the beginning, I don't think there's an optimal diet for humans. I'm experimenting. I'm learning. I'm evolving. I don't want to be someone that's calcified, ossified, or fossilized in my beliefs. I definitely think that there are people out there in the nutrition space who are like that, and I've never really understood it, but that's where I'm at now, and that feels pretty good to me. I've had slightly more protein in the past, perhaps slightly less carbohydrates in the past, but I think that my fat has been higher, if anything, in the past. And on a daily basis, if I'm going to eat more calories than that, the carbohydrates might bump up a little bit, and the fat might bump up a little bit, predominantly from sources like cheese, fat from meat, and raw whole goat or cow's milk. So hopefully that's helpful. Let's run through all of that one more time. Removal, 4 steps. Seed oils, high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and vegetables. leaves, stems, seeds of plants, seeds being seeds, nuts, grains, and beans. 4 steps to adding things to make what I believe is the optimal starting point diet for humans. Add organs, either fresh or desiccated. Add the proper amount of protein. Add carbohydrates from fruit and honey, which I believe are the least toxic sources. And get animal fats as the predominant source of your fat. So this is an animal-based diet. Organs, meat, fruit, honey, and raw dairy. I think that if you look at the medical literature, you will find that it is very nutrient-rich, that the nutrients are bioavailable. And you will find that it is very low in toxins. I didn't really talk about this when I was talking about the meat in this diet, but I don't really like to eat fish. Although if you guys want to eat it, you can. It's just higher in heavy metals and higher in perfluoroalkylated substances and higher in microplastics, et cetera. And I'm not a huge fan of chicken and pork because they're much higher in linoleic acid when they're fed corn and soy. So I don't want to make the diet so stringent in the paradigm that no one will be able to do it, but I do want to give you guys a perspective on which meats I choose or which meats I favor in my life and which meats I avoid because of the toxin piece. Now, you'll also find that if you look at anthropology or you visit hunter-gatherer tribes, there's not many of them left on the planet. This is essentially how they eat. The notion that the Hadza love vegetables is just false. I don't think any of the researchers that say this have ever spent any time with the Hadza. They clearly want to hunt every single day. They want to hunt. They want to eat meat and organs first. If they find honey, that's like their favorite thing and they'll eat it like crazy. If they find berries, the whole tribe does a little dance and they get excited. If they find baobab fruit, they'll eat it. And if they find other fruits, they'll eat them when they're in season. But really, they love honey the most. Not surprisingly, low fiber, good carbohydrate sources, and then meat and organs. And there are even studies by Frank Marlowe, who's done a lot of work with the Hadza, showing that tubers are a fallback food for them and that their favorite foods are honey, meat, baobab, and berries, and that tubers are a distant fifth. That's just anthropology research. I didn't make that up. This is a guy who did his PhD thesis on the Hadza. And you see that pattern repeatedly, and it's kind of intuitive. Think about yourself being in the jungle or the forest or the bush in Africa. What are you going to eat? If you find a hive of bees, you're going to smoke those bees out. Hope you know how to make fire. If you find an animal and you can hunt and kill it, you're going to eat that with the tribe. And if you find ripe fruit, you're going to do that. And ripe fruit is available frequently near the equator. Here in Costa Rica, there's different fruits all year round at the farmer's market. Honey is available year round in places where humans have evolved. And where honey is available, all humans eat it. They do not shun it. In fact, it's universally loved as a good nutrient source and a good calorie source to help us do the metabolic work we need to do. So this is what I believe is a good starting point for your diet. Obviously, I want you to tweak it. I want you to think about it. I want you to test it and test drive it. I want you to take this for a drive around the corner and squeal the tires and hit the emergency brake and see how it works and see what doesn't work. Not accept what I'm saying is canon and question it for yourself. But this is my perspective on why an animal-based diet works, what it's consisting of, a step-by-step approach to get there. And again, join us for Animal-Based 30, animalbased30.com with heart and soil. All right, guys, that's it for this week. Next week, I'm probably going to talk about different types of sugars and go more into the artificial sweetener stuff.